for the last 2.5 years, my life has been all about the Faceless Man. It's pretty much all I've talked about, all I've read about. I thought writing a novel was all-consuming. This has been on another level. And I think that's because, deep down, I know this is non-fiction. This podcast is about something that actually happened to real people. One of my first conversations was with Setsuko, Mikio Miyazawa's mother, grandmother to Nina and Rei. And talking to her, it really got to me. The way she smiled as she recalled the memories of her lost son. What a thing to hear a 91-year-old woman say that all she lives for is to know why her family had to die. She's such a brave woman, and after all these years, she deserves answers. Thinking back to that, I realized maybe I'd lost sight of the goal. There's so much detail in this case, so many elements I've explored, theories which may or may not be true, and I've pulled at every single thread to see where it would take me. And maybe, in all that, I'd lost myself a bit. I did find out many things along the way, and we do know more about this killer than we did. But all these months later, I still don't feel any closer to knowing who he is. When I started out, my objective was to give the Faceless Man a face. So, in many ways, I'm back at the beginning. I told you up front, this was a paradox, that for every explanation, there was another one to contradict it. So in this episode, I'm going back to the one thing in this case which I believe can give us answers. DNA. From USG Audio and What's the Story Sounds, this is Faceless. Episode 7. Alright, so let's rewind to episode 2. I told you then, the killer's DNA was left all over the crime scene. Remember, the blood-stained glove in the kitchen, on the killer's clothes, on the sushi knife, on his hip bag, the things he touched, the things he ate, the things he drank, the things he left behind. Former Tokyo police chief Takeshi Tsuchita even remarked on this quantity of DNA left behind.
Mainichi Shimbun.
There was just so much. Normally at the crime scene, you need to look carefully for tiny clues. You don't always know what you're looking for. But here, it was everywhere, in every room. The killer left his clothes behind. We had fingerprints, we had blood, we had his bag, a knife. In all my years as an officer, I've never seen a case with more evidence to collect.
I told you how the TMPD publicly refused to talk about the killer's DNA. The test results had been leaked, revealing a mix of East Asian and Mediterranean ancestry. That the genetic markers told us he was more likely to be Korean than Japanese. And that's about all the DNA had been able to reveal. The chief went to great lengths to explain to me just how limited police in Japan are when it comes to using DNA.
One of the difficulties of the investigation is that we are facing so many questions. Why did the killer leave so many fingerprints, so much DNA? Why did the killer pick that spot? Why did the killer kill this entire family? And we haven't really been able to narrow down as there's no clear motive. DNA and fingerprints will, however, point to the killer's profile, but there's no legal framework in Japan for DNA-based investigation. So the only way currently to catch him by DNA would be if he was arrested by the police for another crime. Then we could match the DNA from the crime scene to his DNA. In Japan, you can only match DNA to DNA. You cannot build a profile where DNA can be used to identify someone.
Japanese law prevents the police from doing anything other than the most basic DNA match. In fact, it's so prohibitive that police in Japan aren't even allowed to ask experts from other countries what it is that they do.
The Japanese police cannot ask American police about what methods they used in their DNA reconstructions and in their DNA investigations. But I would love to talk to scientists or read articles. Any receive any information about what methods are used, what sort of data one needs to provide, what sort of evidence one needs to provide. I would like to know the methods and the data that's needed to do facial reconstructions in these thorough DNA-based investigations.
Now, I find it incredible that there isn't this kind of communication in place already. Then again, if the law prevents police from using more complex techniques, then I suppose, what's the point in understanding them? But none of this stopped me from finding out what the Japanese police are missing. So, I reached out to Colleen Fitzpatrick. She's a leading forensic genealogist and pioneer in the development of forensic genetic genealogy for solving violent crime and cold cases. We met for coffee about an hour south of LA, where her company, Identifying as International, is based. And she gave me a crash course in just what's possible today.
Conventionally, the police collect evidence from a crime scene. They review the evidence. They extract DNA from those pieces of evidence. They send it to the lab. The lab makes a profile of that DNA. The profile's uploaded to a database with similar profiles, and they look for a match that's already in the database, which may indicate who the criminal is. And then if they don't get a hit, then generally the investigation starts, and the police sometimes collect DNA samples from suspects that they compare to that crime scene DNA to see if they find out who did the crime.
What Colleen has described is what does happen in Japan. It's a straightforward process, which hasn't changed for the last 30 years. It's all based around testing 20 markers in your DNA, a standardized system. And if the 20 markers on one sample match the 20 markers on another, well, it's 99.999% certain. Though the DNA database is pretty thin, Tokyo police did put the faceless man's DNA into it, and there was no match. But Colleen says there are now other ways to use that DNA, ways that look at much more than just 20 markers.
Today, with genetic genealogy, we use a different kind of marker called a SNP, which is more of a point on the DNA. And as a consequence, when you get tested on 500,000 or 600,000 points. And it becomes not so much a one-to-one match, but how many of these points you share with other people in the database. More you share, the closer you're related. The less you share, the more distant you're related.
These new techniques can throw up dozens, even thousands of partial matches. Colleen told me they're valuable clues.
So when I see my results, it'll be a list of people who share DNA with me. And it's like a big Sudoku puzzle. I'll see a first cousin, a third cousin, a second cousin once removed, an aunt and uncle. I won't know who these people are, but I'll find out and I'll figure out how they related to me based on how much DNA they share. And then it's up to me to put that Sudoku puzzle together so it all makes sense.
Armed with this new technique, experts such as Colleen have been able to solve cases and bring offenders to justice. Perhaps most notably, the Golden State Killer. And Colleen felt the same could be possible here. She told me she didn't even need the killer's DNA to do it.
The police could send me the Y profile on the case, and I could compare that to the genetic genealogy databases to possibly find a last name for this guy. Even if I could not find a last name, I could probably say the ethnicity, which would be East Asian, but I might be able to get a nationality, which would be a step forward, which they don't have right now. All they needed to do would be send me the results, a PDF file or an Excel spreadsheet, and I could work with that.
Colleen spoke to me at length, and I was getting more and more frustrated. Everything she was telling me could give the Tokyo police an answer. Even if her techniques might not directly identify the killer, they could give them a heck of a lot more certainty.
It would take me no time at all. I would search the genetic genealogy Y-DNA databases. I have software to do that. Any piece of intelligence, investigative intelligence, is worth it. You know, it takes you one step closer. Perfect. It's worth it.
And she finished by bringing into question something that Chief Suchita had told me. Remember the leaked information about the faceless man's DNA? Information which led me to believe he's mixed race, half East Asian and half Mediterranean. Well, Colleen said that interpretation was likely wrong.
Now, that doesn't mean he's half East Asian and half Mediterranean. It just means that the two single gender lines, the direct male line and the direct female line, have those ethnicities. The mitochondria, it's going back forever. So it's his mother's mother, mother, mother. Keep saying mother as many times as you want. It could be his great, 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 great grandmother. We don't know. It could be his mother's Italian, which means it's a recent immigrant. But it could have been Marco Polo's sister who went to China or maybe Japan with him. And that was hundreds of years ago. And she stayed there and she married into the Japanese culture. And so today, if you saw the mother, she looked completely Japanese.
So essentially, there wouldn't really have been a way in the year 2000 for anybody to know that the man who murdered the Miyazawa family was half this or half that in a black and white way.
Correct.
If that's the case, well, there isn't actually much reason to believe that the killer appeared anything other than fully Japanese. So the idea that he was mixed race, yeah, technically speaking, that's true. But then the same likely goes for most of us. And the idea that the killer maybe looked different, it just may not be true at all. But that got me thinking. The chief had also spoken about how the killer looked. He'd asked me about facial reconstructions. Now, Kalina told me that DNA tests could reveal eye color and hair color of a suspect. But what she hadn't told me was that DNA could create a reconstruction of a face. So I did some more digging, and I found a lab, Parabon in the US, and they claim that was exactly what was possible. Their chief is Dr. Ellen Graytak.
In traditional forensic DNA analysis, the DNA is sort of treated like a fingerprint, and it's really great for direct matching. But if your person isn't in the database, isn't one of the suspects who have been identified, then traditional forensic DNA analysis couldn't tell you anything else. So Snapshot is the technology that we at Parabon have developed to analyze DNA from a crime scene. And instead of just reading off that barcode, it actually reads the blueprints, the pieces of the DNA that code for the physical appearance of that person. And so we can tell the detective, you're looking for someone of this ancestral background with this eye color, this hair color, this face shape, and all of that together with their other investigative information can really help narrow it down, because a lot of these cold cases, I mean, they're cold for a reason, because the person who committed this crime is not one of the obvious suspects or they would have found him. And so instead, what we see is in a lot of these cases, they just need some new piece of information. How detectives like to work is, you know, okay, we're starting with, you know, the whole population of the world and then trying to narrow it down of who this person could be. And so when we present our results, you know, we can't predict the exact shade of blue of the person's eye, but we can tell you with, you know, 99% confidence that this is a person who does not have brown eyes, for example. And so the detectives can use that information to prioritize, you know, who should we be looking for. We do produce a composite. So the predictions that we run produce a three-dimensional basically a three-dimensional shape of that person's face, as well as predictions of their skin color, eye color, hair color, and level of freckling. And then we have a forensic artist who has to put those pieces of information together, you know, turn a, you know, this person has blonde hair into an actual composite of a person with blonde hair.
Okay, wow. So we're talking about 3D images of a suspect nobody has ever seen before. A mugshot without the mug. It was incredible.
So one of the really important things to remember is that we don't know anything that's not written in the DNA. So the person's age or their weight or scars, tattoos, how they wear their hair, their, you know, facial hair, glasses. There's a lot of information. You know, if someone gets new glasses and you say you look so different.
But I kept thinking back to that wanted poster in Tokyo, the one that's still up all over the city. The one that shows the clothes on a faceless mannequin. How much stronger of a chance would there be in recognizing him if the public could see not just what he wore, but to look into his eyes? With two new potential routes for a modern DNA investigation, I went back to the chief. And I told him about everything I'd learned. I offered to introduce him to those labs, those experts, to see for himself the techniques that are happening right now. And incredibly, he mentioned that he'd heard about the idea of DNA being used in these ways. But as I looked at his face, it seemed as if he couldn't quite believe that these things were actually possible. As if the ways in which DNA is being used in America and elsewhere was just so far away from what he had ever experienced. Yet, despite the possibilities, the chief reiterated that without a change in protocol, without a change in the law, none of these new techniques would ever be allowed in Japan.
Really, what we are doing is appealing to society, and we are asking everyone in Japan to put themselves in the shoes of the bereaved and to think of their pain and think of what they can do to change the situation. The police don't request DNA from the public because of privacy reasons, but I ask them to think of the privacy of the victims who have zero privacy.
And the change that the chief wants is a new law, new legal framework which allows DNA to be used in certain criminal cases beyond the strictly one-to-one way which is currently employed.
We have sent the petitions, but the police don't want to. They don't actually want the establishment of a legal framework. Why? Because it's too much hard work to create this legal framework. The head of the police has a career to think about. And he's only in post for a limited amount of time. So he wants to take on tasks that he can achieve during that time.
It's little wonder that Chief Tsuchita is frustrated. He wants action. And a few weeks later, he organized a press conference. With our findings and more knowledge on the DNA possibilities, he'd invited the nation's media to hear him appeal directly for a change in the law.
I begged the chief of the police and the National Public Safety Commission to think of the pain of the victims and their bereaved families and ask themselves what they can do. Can they live? Can they forgive themselves for not doing everything that they can do?
The press wrote everything down. His pleas were aired on some national TV. It's amazing to think that press conferences like this even need to happen. That a nation like Japan needs to have a campaign to raise awareness of the power of these investigative techniques. But then you can't forget that this is a cultural issue. Privacy is sacred. DNA is yours and yours alone. When that's always been the way, change maybe isn't so easy. The press conference ended in a maybe unexpected way. Chief Sujita was joined by others from a charity, Bereaved Families of Murder. They've joined together to give these pleas more clout. Because if one bereaved family isn't enough to change a law, then how many will it take? The group also announced the release of a new song, which they hope will raise public awareness of their plight. It's not something I would expect to see in the US or the UK. But then, if music can make a difference, if it can make people sit up and join the cause, then I'm all for it. Listen closely, and you'll notice Chief Sujita lending his voice to the track. The chief told me he won't give up, but it could take 2 or 3 years at least to get this framework in place. The time is running out. I spoke to Setsuko as I neared the end of my journey. While I hadn't promised her any answers, I could sense the disappointment that nothing had changed. And she told me she was losing hope. It was hard to hear her say that.
I don't know if I can expect any sort of resolution. And all I can hope is that something comes out while I'm alive. But if we found out who was behind it, rather than me saying anything to them, rather than me deciding their penalty, I would. I want them to take responsibility themselves to recognize the depths of their crimes and to take the appropriate responsibility themselves. But even so, it really feels like we haven't taken a single step forward towards solving this case. So I really don't know what will happen. The only question I have is why? And that's why I keep going. I keep going because I want to know why. And I'm sure that the police are doing their best in their investigations. But I'm sure they are trying hard. But I feel like they haven't made any progress. I feel like they haven't made a single step forward.
Knowing that an answer could be right around the corner, if only DNA were used differently, it's hard to imagine how Setsuko stays so serene. In that final talk with her, with Chief Sujita on the line, they spoke briefly together. And maybe I'm wrong here, but I did get the impression that it reminded the chief just how much it would mean to Setsuko to have the truth.
I'll just quickly translate what Chief Sujita just said to Miyazawa-san, because it's quite interesting.
I heard the word DNA.
Yeah, so he said, listening to you renewed my belief that we must make some progress with solving this case. And I'm also hoping that we can do something with DNA, that we should that we can continue to hold hope for DNA to unlock some answers. So we as Sora no Kai, we will keep doing our best to try and get this case solved. And please, Miyazawa-san, you keep doing your best too. Please don't lose hope. And then she said, I'm over 90 now, so I hope we solve it soon. And he replied, well, these days a lifetime is over 100 years, so we've still got a good chunk of time left to solve this.
We've passed all the findings from this podcast to the Tokyo Metropolitan Police, including the names and contacts for labs and specialists. It's understood that they can't and they won't comment. But I like to think, just maybe, it's given them some kind of renewed hope too. And for what it's worth, I don't think they will ever stop trying or caring about this case. But perhaps a change in the law could finally give them the opportunity to solve this. So, after all this, 2.5 years for me, 7 episodes for you. What do we know? Well, we know so many intimate details about the killer. The shape of his body, what he smelled like, what was in his stomach, what was in his blood, how long his hair was. We know he had a sweet tooth. We know he was curious or looking for something. We know that, for whatever reason, he wanted that entire family dead. And he was willing to take great risks in order to go through with that, even after serious injury. And we know that, in a house full of blood and dead bodies, he made himself at home. It paints a picture of a specific man. And yet, for all we do know, there's still so much that's still up in the air. Like Colleen said, we're not actually sure if his DNA does tell us that he's mixed race. We still don't know where the mention of the sand grains from Edwards Air Base arose from. We still don't know what, if any, connection the killer had to the Miyazawa family. We're not even sure how he entered or left the house. In episode 3, we heard the chief say there was no proof either. No bloody footprints at the front door, which was apparently locked. But then again, no fibres whatsoever in the bathroom window. On and on these unknowns go. Like I said at the beginning, this is not a mystery. It's a paradox. And it still is. And it seems as if it always will be, until a breakthrough is made, most likely to come in the form of technological advances. We've heard a lot of theories about why the Miyazawa family were murdered, but I've never revealed my own until now. For me, everything goes back to the sand in the hip bag. Everything. I believe the faceless man was connected to the US Air Force. He had to be. He was carrying sand from a closed military facility in California. The chief couldn't explain how the killer's DNA mixed with American sand in that bag, a bag with no other DNA profile. So, one way or another, for me, that connection can't be discounted. It means that the killer, whether directly connected to the US Air Force or the son of someone who is, most likely went through Edwards Air Base to Yokota Air Base. Yokota Air Base would allow him to enter and leave Japan without giving any records to Japanese authorities. As a US military base, it would also likely provide a safe haven for him immediately after the murders. But if this theory has occurred to me, it will have occurred to the TMPD. So, why wouldn't they follow those sand grains leading to America? I don't buy that they wouldn't bother out of laziness. On the face of it, that makes no sense. Unless it does. I think that following the killer to America could mean opening a can of worms. It could mean, if he's caught, Japan executing an American pretty much for the first time since World War II. The US and Japan rely on each other. They have a close relationship. How would suddenly having to extradite a US citizen for an execution affect that? Or would that even be approved? And what would look worse? The faceless man simply remaining a mystery? Or potentially knowing who he is, but not being able to touch him for political reasons? I have limited evidence backing up my theory, except for the sand. But it does explain many of the elements here. And it's one of the few theories which makes sense, at least to me. I first came across their case years ago in a hotel lobby in Tokyo, just because I was jet-lagged. I wonder sometimes how things might have been different if I had been able to sleep that night. But then again, maybes don't matter. Maybes are for novelists. And this isn't a novel. This is a true story. A story that doesn't belong to me or to you, and certainly not the man who took the Miyazawa family. It's been almost 22 years since that night. 22. Nina would be almost 30 years of age right now. Rei would be well into his 20s. Mikio and Yasuko would be nearing retirement. Perhaps Setsuko would even be a great-grandmother, living out her days, surrounded by love. not hoping against hope for horrific answers. The man who did this has to pay for that. But the world gets smaller and smaller for him each day. The DMPD will never give up. Nor will Setsuko. Nor will Chief Tsuchita. Nor will I, for that matter. There is hope for the day when this man is finally dragged out from the shadows and forced into the light. Until then, while he remains faceless, I hope that the faces of Mikio Miyazawa, Yasuko, Nina, and Rei are seen, are remembered, and are never forgotten. This podcast was written and hosted by me, Nick Obregón. My producers for What's the Story Sounds are Daryl Brown and Sophie Ellis. In Japan, my producer is Ryushi Lindsay. Sound design by Tom Bruins. My music is composed by James Warburton and KPM Music. Our USG audio team includes Josh Block and Jennifer Sears. This is a USG audio podcast in collaboration with What's the Story Sounds. If you have any information or leads on this case, please email faceless@whatsthestorysounds.com or reach out to us on Twitter. And if you've enjoyed this series, please leave us a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. And check out more USG audio podcasts at usgaudio.com.